Welcome. My name is Eric Austin. I'm the Executive Director of the Burton K. Wheeler Center for Public Policy. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. I am really excited to see so many folks coming out to think about and talk about divisiveness in democracy. Last spring, when I announced that we were going to be hosting this event, this lecture, and the conference tomorrow at another event that we were holding, I said, we've got this upcoming event, we're going to be talking about divisiveness and democracy, and there was an instance of silence in the room, and then sort of nervous, somewhat cynical, somewhat knowing laughter from almost everybody in the room. A little bit kind of saying, why would you wade into the difficulties of divisiveness and democracy? For me, as a political scientist, this is a critical issue. Was joking around a little bit with somebody in advance of this lecture this evening, sort of saying, okay, is the aim to hold hands and sing Kumbaya? And of course, no, that's not the case, and I don't really want to do that anyway. But more importantly, right, the issue here is that we need a certain amount of conflict. We need a certain amount of difference and disagreement in politics. If democracy is partly about a marketplace of ideas, we need those different ideas. We need that conflict. We need to be able to sort of vet those ideas and make them better. But we're somewhere else on the other end of the continuum, right? That discourse, the discord, has become dysfunctional. So how do we do something different? My work as a political scientist has really been at the grassroots level, working with communities, working with organizations, trying to do creative problem solving, trying to find ways of overcoming interest-based divisiveness. I'm very excited about tonight's lecture because our speaker this evening is talking about a different venue than I work in, one that frankly scares me a little bit. Working in legislative sessions or legislative environments, that seems pretty daunting to me. So I'm very excited to hear about the strategies and approaches and processes and how those are working. Obviously today, you can't go a day, you can't go an hour without hearing stories about how difficult the political environment is, how dysfunctional the political environment is. What's encouraging, though, is that you are all here. And if you've been reading the paper in the last couple of days, if you picked up the IR this morning, you saw a letter to, or you saw an editorial talking about opportunities in this conference and ways forward. And there have been a number of those editorials, a number of pieces in the last couple of weeks, suggesting that maybe there is some space, maybe there is a way forward. We're hopeful to contribute to that, to move things at least a little bit in the right direction. So again, thank you for coming out. I want to get to the lecture, get to the comments as quickly as we can tonight, but I do need to say a couple of thank yous and make some acknowledgments, mostly to the board of the Wheeler Center, who has really championed this topic and has been enormously supportive in not only moving the event forward, but really helping think about what is it that's going on here? What's the substance? What's the content of this? And particularly need to acknowledge the person who's going to follow me and introduce our speaker tonight, and that's Chuck Tooley, who some of you may know as the longest-serving mayor of Billings, Montana, who is the person on our board who really took on this topic and is among all of us probably the most passionate about it. And so without further ado, I'm going to invite Chuck to come up and introduce our speaker. But thank you very much, Chuck.
Thank you, Eric. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good. You don't have to do that now, Ted. I've done it for you. I'm just delighted to see so many people here tonight, especially good friends who have come to learn about this subject and to listen to tonight's speaker. Ted Celeste is Director of State Programs for the National Institute for Civil Discourse and heads the organization's Next Generation Project. His bipartisan team facilitates training for state legislators. And Ted's goal is to inspire and support those who want to promote greater understanding and better decision-making. After graduating from the College of Worcester, Celeste and his wife taught school in Fiji through the Peace Corps. Following that, he served as acting chief of the Bureau of Consumer Services in the Ohio Department of Public Welfare, and then in the Ohio Department of Finance. A former real estate developer, Ted helped chair Governor and Brother Dick Celeste in his gubernatorial campaigns and Ted Strickland's 2006 gubernatorial campaign. Ted also served for 9 years on the Ohio State University Board of Trustees. Ted served in the Ohio Legislature from 2007 to 2012. Known for working effectively across the aisle, whether he was in the majority or the minority, he has lived his belief in respectful dialogue. One of the only candidates for state office who insisted on running a positive campaign, he won each of his three races with a comfortable majority in a swing district. He was recognized for his emphasis on civil dialogue with the John Glenn Public Policy Institute's Outstanding Public Service Award in 2011. Ted lives in Columbus, Ohio, is married, has two daughters and three grandchildren, and I would like you to help me give Ted Celeste a warm Montana welcome.
And I must apologize to Eric. Well, actually, he needs to apologize to me because my intro was going to be to have all of you hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Not really, Eric. I'm really excited to be here, and Chuck, thanks so much for making this possible, and all the folks on the board for all the good work that you do. This is certainly a passion of mine, and hopefully throughout this conversation tonight, you'll see where it got its birth and where it came from and where it's headed. And what I hope to do tonight is set a little context for you about civility, what it is, where we are in 2016, who's doing something about it, and in particular our organization, the National Institute for Civil Discourse, what we're doing about it, in particular what my program is doing about it. I'm pretty excited about it, and you'll hear all that passion come through about how this was a dream of mine many years ago, and then kind of give a context for where we go from here and what's happening around the country. So let me begin with what do you all see up there? How many see the woman? How many see the woman? How many see the saxophone player? Which one's right? They're both right. This is the beginning of where incivility happens. You believe that what you see is the truth, even though somebody else might see something else in the exact same frame. So part of the discussion about civility begins with our perception and understanding of what reality is, how we can have discussion, the importance of words as part of that discussion. And so let's move into what's happening now. So there was a recent study done by Weber Shandwick here in the country, 2016, found that 70% of Americans said they felt incivility in this country has risen to crisis levels. They also found 83% of likely voters report that they're paying close attention to national politics, and nearly all likely voters, 93%, say a candidate's tone or level of civility will be an important factor in deciding how they cast their votes in the 2016 presidential election. However, the perception is that civil discourse is in need of some serious help. And we have found that the lack of civil discourse has presented us with a major problem here in this country. And if you look at these numbers, 6 in 10 people agree with the statement the 2016 election will go down as one of the most negative elections. Same 60% say the election will get more negative before November. I mean, we all watch every day. We see the headlines. We see what's happening and see how it's unfolding. And what happens? This level of discussion at the national level impacts what's happening to all of us as we're watching this go on around us. This recent survey had 4,385 Americans surveyed. 31% of Democrats, 27% of Republicans said it would be harder to get along with a new person in their community if they happened to belong to the other party. 60% of both Republicans and Democrats said by the end of the conversation with individuals from an opposing party, they tend to find they'd have less in common politically with the other person than they previously thought. Well, what are Republicans and Democrats saying about each other? Well, 52% of Republicans say Democrats are more closed-minded than other Americans. 70% of Democrats say Republicans are more closed-minded than other Americans. And so it's not much of a wonder why it's hard to reach across the aisle. And Republicans with few Democrats friends are far more likely to have very cold feelings toward Democrats and vice versa. If you look here among Republicans, if you have a lot of friends, you feel somewhat cold. If you have a few or none, you're much colder towards them, both among Republicans for Democrats and among Democrats for Republicans. So where has this all taken us? I mean, you've seen it, you heard it, you've heard it in the papers, you've seen the headlines. They were referred to earlier by Eric. Daily, I have a Google alert on civil discourse, on civility, on incivility, and I used to get maybe one hit a week. And now I get a half a dozen to a dozen a day in terms of the level of the conversation. People are really angry about this and talking about this, and folks are saying, what can we do? So there's a number of institutions, and interestingly enough, I'm going to add one to my list here after this presentation when I'll include the Wheeler Center. These are a number of organizations around the country that have said, how do we engage people in meaningful dialogue at the local level? How can we really converse? How can we have a conversation that doesn't get to the level of name-calling, et cetera? So these are all folks interested in trying to create the kind of dialogue and environment that people will be able to talk to one another. Quite a few more organizations, and many of you may have heard of some of these. And in this slide is where I think I would include Montana State and the Wheeler Center, who is another organization that's dealing with it. So The National Institute for Civil Discourse is the organization that that I work for. And as you can see, it's a nonpartisan center for advocacy, research, and policy seeking to transform incivility and political dysfunction to strengthen American democracy. And it is a recent creation, and unfortunately, it was created in 2011 upon the tragic shooting of Congressman Gabrielle Giffords. And the community said, what can we do to make something positive about this from this horrible event? And so the university got together with the town, and they created the National Institute for Civil Discourse within the university. Is that an echo? Yeah, heckler already. How do you like that? So it was put together with the aim in mind to really commemorate the spirit that Gabrielle Giffords had, both when she was a congressperson as well as when she was in the state legislature in Arizona. And so she and a number of other people were on the board, including both Bill Clinton and Bush 1, as well as a number of other prominent Republicans and Democrats, so it's a pretty powerful national board. Their focus was to look at not only elected officials, but the public and the media, all of whom have a role in the creation of the incivility that's going on today. And so how can we help that process? So what the Institute did was create this number of programs in right after the Sandy Hook shootings. President Obama said we need to have a national dialogue on mental health in the country and asked our executive director, Carolyn Lukensmeyer, if she could put together a national group of folks to really deal with this discussion of mental health. Out of that work and thousands of people involved in a number of states came this program called Text Talk Act. And it was an effort to reach out to the younger folks who are familiar with the phone, iPhone, and using it for texting purposes to really get at issues which were impacting them, both having an ability to get rid of the stigma of talking about mental health, about suicide, and about bullying. And so it is a program which allows folks to enter one word, and you get a number of stimulations back, and you interact with the program, and it then allows young people together in small groups of three or four or five or six to have a real discussion. And that discussion gets added to a national discussion, and it's quite a process. That platform, that texting platform, has now been used in a number of other capacities by the Institute. Text Talk Revives Civility, I'll tell you about at the end of the discussion, and Text Talk Vote, which is another application that's used in 2016, again, to get young people involved. It was tested in 2014 in New Hampshire, where young people were not very engaged in the process of that election. And 50% of the people who were interviewed who were using this program said they were not likely to vote. After they used the program, 20% of the 50% actually voted. So this is being used in a number of states now in 2016 to try to engage young people in that process. And then the other program down here at the bottom, Next Generation, that's my baby. So Next Generation came about. Let me back up for you and tell you how I came to the Institute with this program. In the early 2000s, Scott Peck, who wrote The Road Less Traveled, called our church, it's a kind of progressive church in Columbus, Ohio, said, "You've always been involved in activities that have some importance in the community. Would you be interested in developing a program, Faith in American Politics, that gets the faith community involved in the political process in a meaningful way?" And so my minister reached out to my wife and I and said, "Will you help us develop the program?" We put together a program called Faith in American Politics. It was a curriculum that was used 10 years ago during Lent. So it was an 8-week program. And for 18 people as a group would get together each of those 8 weeks for about 3 hours and really talk about the important issues that were going on in their life at that time and getting to know each other better. And it was a curriculum that was developed put together and then shared with other congregations around the country. It had a tremendous impact on me. I found myself exploring parts of my belief system, who I was, what I valued, and really said to me, if we're going to do something with this, we got to reach out to a larger community. So it was about that time I was approached by folks in the Democratic caucus in the Ohio House of Representatives who said, there's a race in that you live in for House seat. There's a Republican incumbent. We think you can win. Would you be interested? And I said, well, I think I'd be interested only if I can do it by running a positive campaign, based on kind of that experience I just had with Faith in American Politics. And the caucus and those political professionals, they looked at me and they said, well, no, if you want any money from us, you're going to listen to us. And I said, okay, I'll do it on my own. I won't go out and raise the money, and I'll do it on my own. And I approached someone who'd been a part of helping to create that organization, Faith in American Politics. He was a pediatric heart surgeon, kind of been an independent, not really a Democrat, an independent, never done anything like this. I said, I would like you to chair my campaign. He said, well, okay, but I've not done anything, but I'll do it on one condition, only if you stay to your purpose and your a positive campaign. I said, okay, I'm happy to do that, but I'll warn you something. There'll be a time during the campaign when someone will come to me and say, you've got to go negative, and I'm going to need to call you up. He said, okay, I'll be there. So campaign went well. I was running a positive campaign, door-to-door, getting positive feedback. A lot of the Republicans who were there were very favorable, saying thank you very much. Out comes the negative literature. Celeste is an Italian name, so they made it out to be on the literature, to have the logo of the Godfather on there, and said, he'll make you a deal you can't refuse on taxes. That wasn't all that bad, but so I called up my friend Terry, and I said, I'm going to need your help. Sure enough, my caucus called. Okay, how are we going to get him? What are you going to say? What are you going to do? I said, nothing. I'm going to talk about what I'm going to do when I get in office, and you're not going to do anything either. And Terry and I wrote off a letter, and it worked, and we got a co-endorsement from the Republican paper in town as a result of that process. The irony of all this, the candidate I was running against was named Smith. His father changed his name from Esposito. You know, now the people doing the research you'd think they would get that information, but it was hard to believe. At any rate, so So that was an important part of my life. I thought, okay, I did the positive campaign. I'm going to go into office, and I'm going to be able to work across the aisle. First day I'm in caucus. What happens? Caucus leadership says, don't meet with the Republicans. They're the enemy. That was the first day, and I'm thinking, this is not why I came here. And so I decided again that I'd have to do it my own way. And made efforts on all my bills to reach across the aisle. One time really pointed out what gave me the incentive then to move on to take this somewhere else. I'd been in part of the minority. In 2008, we won the majority. So I was a committee chair. This was great. I was going to be able to get lots of stuff done. I had a bill that I wanted to pass. I've been working on dyslexia, not a very partisan issue. And I said, I need a really good co-sponsor. I found the best one I could have had, I thought, who was the minority leader, the Republican minority leader. He said, I'm excited about this. We'll get it passed. My caucus said to me, you can't do that. And I said, why? There's an important election coming up in 2010, and we don't want people to think that Republicans care. I said, come on, you're kidding. And they said, nope. So I said, well, we're going to do it anyway. Well, it didn't matter because they were in charge, so the bill didn't go anywhere. We lost the election. The Republican minority leader became the speaker. He came to me after the election and said, we've got to get our bill passed. I'll get you another Republican to work with, and we can get it done. And that's the way it was supposed to be done from the beginning. So to me, it said something about how bad the process had gotten. So I was convinced when now the Republicans are back in power and they redistricted me out of my district, so I could have run again. But what I decided is I wanted to put together a group that would focus on teaching my fellow colleagues, legislators, how to find common ground, modeled after that Faith in American Politics program, where it was intensive interrelationship development. It wasn't quite singing Kumbaya, but it was really, really looking at the relationship and building relationships, building trust. And so that was how I took it to the National Institute. They were focusing on D.C. at the time. 50% of the people who go to Congress come from state houses. I said, let's work on state houses. Great, they said. So in 2012, we kicked it off. And looking at the map, you can see we've been in a lot of states. We've done 17 workshops in 12 states. One of the most recent states is your neighbor, Idaho, where the president of the Senate, President Pro Tem, and the Speaker of the House invited us to do a workshop for their leadership first, and then invited us to do the workshop for the whole legislature. And it was magnificent. And now one of our best promoters is the Speaker Pro Tem of the Senate in Idaho as a result of that. So this Building Trust Through Civil Discourse is a half-day workshop. It is facilitated by legislators. We have trained 41 legislators around the country, Republicans and Democrats. Each session is done in a bipartisan way. Republican and a Democrat lead the session. And it is making a tremendous difference. So I'm going to give you a little taste of what that workshop is like and what's come about as a result of those workshops. First thing I'd like to do is play a video here that we use in the workshop called Unlikely Friendships. And it's key to what we try to transmit in our sessions. It would also be something that I'd say, hopefully you can walk away with and say, well, maybe there's a person who's an unlikely friend of mine who's way on the other side of the spectrum that I've never really had coffee with, and I'm going to have coffee with him. And let me play this for you, and you can see what I mean.
Well, a friend of mine passed away, and she was all about reconciliation, always about reaching out to people, and to unlikely people. When she passed away, I wanted to do something to honor her. And I thought, who would be the most unlikely person on the planet that I would reach out to? And it was Bob.
I'm the president and CEO of The Family Leader. And our mission statement is to strengthen families by inspiring Christ-like leadership in the home, the church, and government.
I'm the executive director at One Iowa, which is the state's largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender organization. I've been an activist and an advocate and sometimes an agitator in this movement for almost 30 years.
Well, Donna and I, we see the world very differently. And our view on marriage, on sexuality, and probably on a host of a lot of other issues.
I guess you'd have to say that my impression of Bob was not only he was the opposition, he was the enemy.
I've probably made statements about her and her organization in the press. She's probably made statements about me and my organization in the press. We weren't natural allies. We weren't natural coffee buddies. And so she emailed the family leader and said, hey, I talked to Bob, and Bob said he'd be willing to do coffee. Let me know a good time of day. And so they shared that email with me like, is this true? I mean, is this real? And I said, yeah, it's real, but I never thought she'd follow up on it.
I never thought that he would respond.
And so we set a date to have coffee.
And that was the beginning of this amazing journey. I remember walking in just being very nervous. I had no idea what to expect, none at all.
Well, you know, the skeptic in me thought she would have an agenda, and she probably thought I might have an agenda. But as soon as we sat down, I thought, she doesn't have an agenda. She just wants to get to know who I am. And that really compelled me to say, I should want to get to know who she is.
I think when people have the courage to show you who they are, something happens. And so what surprised me about Bob was his humanity. He's an incredible dad. I also found him to be really funny, and I didn't expect that at all. But we laugh a lot.
Donna's a very good person. She's a passionate person. She has advocated for her issues tirelessly for over 3 decades. So regardless if I agree or disagree with her on the issues, I have a tremendous respect for her.
For a long time, I've been really tired of the hate and the aggression and the kind of snarkiness. We can disagree without being disagreeable. We can fight the good fight in the court of public opinion, but we don't have to hurt each other. That's, I think, the big takeaway for me. We don't have to hurt each other, because when we do that, we're hurting ourselves. We get coffee about once every couple of months.
And I think with Donna, her and I readily assessed that we have a lot of common interest. We have some common ground. The only regret in all of that is that I wasn't the one to ask her out for coffee. And she's the one who asked me out. And I'm glad she did, but I kind of feel like I should have.
What surprised me was not that he liked me. I thought, yeah, he'd like me. What surprised me was I really liked him.
It hasn't changed my beliefs. It may have changed my approach. Because when we do put out a press release, when we do make a public statement, many times I think, I wonder how Donna will view this.
Here's the deal. If Bob and I can have coffee, if we can tell stories and laugh and get to know each other, if we can like each other, then I think almost anyone can find that person in their life, and maybe they can reach out their hand and invite them in.
It's a pretty simple but powerful message in terms of how two people who were probably calling each other nasty names before this happened in their literature, and they're probably still saying the same things about their issues, but they're not saying those nasty things about each other, and maybe the beginnings of more finding of the common ground will happen. So that's the beginning of the introduction to our workshop, our half-day workshop. I should say before we actually show that, we share a meal. That was one of the important things going back to the faith in American politics. Sharing a meal with someone has a huge difference. Just like they said, sharing coffee, breaking bread together makes a difference. So we start with a meal, either a breakfast or lunch, and then go for a half a day. And what we're trying to do is create a safe place for people to talk about things that are really important to them. And so to begin that process, and here are three of the key components to that workshop, is the establishment of ground rules, and each state sets their own ground rules. Now we find that 90% of them, everyone says the same things, but in some cases they end up a little different. Clearly, one of the important ones is what goes on in Vegas stays in Vegas. The people who are concerned that this is a confidential discussion. And if they're going to say anything, it's not for attributions, because we'd like them to talk about what goes on there. We just don't want them to attribute words to people who were there. It's okay to talk about it. But other things such as listen, creative listening, do not interrupt, respect the other person's opinion, think before you respond. The interesting thing in that dialogue between the two of them is how many times before they sat down together, they probably were already in their own minds thinking of their own lines of processing, you know, those issues. But if you can really listen, it makes a difference. So the establishment of the ground rules is really important to get us off to the right place. And then what folks say is one of the most impactful parts of our workshop is what's called a political journey. Political journey is, and all of you have something in common, and that is that there's something in your life that profoundly impacted who you are today, where your belief system, where your strong beliefs came from. And you probably don't think about it often, but what we ask people during this exercise is to think about that event in their life which profoundly impacted who they are politically today, not why they ran for office, but where is that value system coming from? And while, again, it's not kumbaya, it is one of those moments that creates unlikely friendships right there, where people are sharing life stories that have a profound impact. Let me give you an example. And I usually, when I'm co-facilitating, I usually will tell this story to kind of give people a view of where they should head with theirs. I grew up in a political family. When I was in the fourth grade, my dad was elected mayor of the town I grew up in, Lakewood, Ohio. And so I knew politics at an early age. And I was blessed because in the 60s, my dad as a Democrat entertained President John Kennedy, who came through town, and I got a chance to meet him. This was incredible for me, had a huge impact on me. One of the reasons, Chuck, why my wife and I went off to the Peace Corps. The message that he had really resonated with me, and the opportunity to meet him at that young age was really important. Well, I went off after graduating from high school to the College of Worcester. I'm a freshman at the College of Worcester in November in that fateful year, 1963, and on my way to a class when I hear the news that the president's been shot. So I take a little transistor radio. You probably remember those little transistors that you could put a little earphone in, and took it to class with me. And this class was an intro class that everybody had to take called Lib Studies, Liberal Studies. And it was being taught by a music professor. And as I came in, he said, "I'm sorry, you're going to have to turn that radio off and not have it in class. We don't allow that." I said, "But the president's been shot." And he looked at me and he said, "Kennedy's come and go, but Bach lives on forever." Oh, I mean, there were already tears in my eye. And so I ignored his advice. I kept the earphone in. I walked to my seat. I sat down, and it wasn't that far into class when they announced the president had died. Now I'm gushing. He could tell what happened. He didn't say a word. He stands up front of the classroom. He folds his books up, walks out, and he creates and writes a requiem that day. 25 years later, I'm at a meeting with classmates at the College of Worcester. One of them was in that same classroom. And going back to that early picture you saw of whether it was a woman or a saxophonist, this is a different view of that same event. Conspiracy theory. The day that JFK was shot in Dallas, I was in Ohio, a Republican, almost 18, my father's voice still on my tongue. He hated JFK, and though I didn't know why, I thought I must hate him too. And so when Ted Celeste burst in the classroom, his voice a sorrow brimming with the news, I leaned back in my seat and said one word. "Good," I said. And all the eyes turned on me, and then class was dismissed. And that one word, armed and dangerous, went out into the world as if I'd blessed the future with my scorn, which echoed back across the century like a lone assassin. Good, good, good. Quite a different perspective of that same event in that classroom. And I had no idea that Ron had written that. He teaches poetry at University of Wisconsin now. Anyway, so the story is meant to get people to be thinking about something that gets you into some territory that you're not necessarily comfortable talking about and opening up. And that works, and it does, and it then gets people set to say, okay, how do we work together? Which is the last piece, action steps. How do we create something that's better than what we have now? What could we do that's not working now that we could be doing together? And that's the action steps that come out of this session. So what kind of luck have we had with this? Well, the exciting thing, well, for me, one of the exciting things is I'm here telling you about this now, and it was all a dream 4 years ago. It's pretty exciting. 17 workshops, 12 states, really impactful, 400 legislators. In some of those states, now the leadership is looking at institutionalizing this program so that people who are newly elected will have this as part of their orientation program. The people who've worked together in the workshop work together on legislation. There's legislation that's been developed across the aisle as a result of this. There are processes in legislature that have improved. In Arizona, just the use of the ground rules that we did in our workshop, the Republican and Democrat took that to the speaker and said, "How about we introduce ground rules to our session so that we don't have name calling on the floor?" They did that, it worked, and the session was different after that. So good things are happening. And finally, there's now a national network of state legislatures committed to civil governance. And this was the first meeting a year ago in Seattle at the National Conference of State Legislators. And we have 50 or so active members from 20 states who are committed to working with each other, sharing best practices. You may notice Gabby Giffords there in the middle. She came out to give the first award to two legislators from Washington State who got our first award. And that group is meeting as we speak on an ongoing basis. As a matter of fact, we have an online meetup on Monday night with that group. And that network has combined with other networks around the country in other areas. And this is something that the Institute is now involved with, and I'm kind of coming to a conclusion here because I know it's after a big meal like that, you get tired. So after getting these groups together, 2016 is upon us. It's really important that we focus on how do we get people involved and be able to respond and take some ownership for it. So we had some convenings. We had one in Ohio. We brought media, elected officials, and civic officials together, talking to each other so they'd listen and hear how they feel about each other's perception and their responsibility for this. We did another one in Ohio in March. Then the follow-up to what we did in Iowa was they did something similar, bringing media and civic leaders together. And that was just done in last month. And I don't know whether any of their articles make their way up here, but it's been really quite something in terms of the impact. So one of the final things I'll mention is that we had this, one of our funders said, things have gotten so bad in 2016 that we really need to organize a national effort to really make a difference. So we started this campaign called Revive Civility, Our Democracy Depends on It. We really kicked it off this summer. We presented it to the National Council of State Legislators. We've created a list of standards of conduct that's on our website. And when people say, what can we do? One of the things you all could do is go to our website. You'll see the standards of conduct. There's a sheet in the back that has the website. And sign up, I agree to it. We've had hundreds of people sign up. It's a simple thing. We're presenting it to folks at the Presidential Debate Commission who have asked us to create similar standards both for the participants, the candidates, the moderator, and the audience. What are the proper standards of conduct? So we've done that for all of them. And so the last piece I'll mention is that so we took that text platform that I told you about, and here's one way that you could go back, work with the folks that you know, small groups or your family, and use this medium as a way to get involved and start that process of working with someone, unlikely friendship. And all it requires is one person with a cell phone who knows about texting, and all you do is text the word civility to the number 89800. You get a series of prompts back. And for 30 or 45 minutes, you are engaged in a discussion that really, first of all, it starts with that video. It starts with a video, encourages you to find that unlikely friendship. And of all the things that I could say, to me, for us, each one of us owning this, how could we make a difference? Think about it. Think how often you all are in a room like this with people just like yourself. You don't really have someone that you don't disagree with, that you disagree with nearby that you can talk to comfortably. And this is a way that you can make a difference by reaching out one person at a time, and it's going to make a huge difference. I'm happy to answer any questions.
So in order for us to capture the audio of your questions for the video recording that we're doing, we've got the stick mic that will run around to you. So if you've got a question, raise your hand. We'll get you the microphone, and you can have at it.
Congressman, or do somebody else have it?
I've got somebody over here.
Okay. How do you like that? You're going to have to wait.
I don't really have a question as much as I have an observation. And that is that regarding the civil discourse or discourse, in my life, I've seen a change in discourse, much of which goes unchallenged. I'll give several examples. One is the word protest. A gentleman named Azure is out in North Dakota now. He's from Fort Belknap, and he was quoted as saying that he didn't think they were protesting out there. They're demonstrating. And I think it's a very good point. But we seem to like to throw the word protest out for any time anybody stands up and talks, and that's a negative that I think is very divisive. And I think that's grown through the years, too. I don't think it used to be that way. Another is, and I'm feeling tense here. another is discussing the president, any president. It seems like lately the attorney general is the president's attorney general. But in reality, he's our attorney general. And I don't know when that started, but it certainly is there now. And it goes without being challenged. And I just think there's a couple of items there that are divisive that don't even get challenged or corrected. And I think it's just a trend that just is, anyway, it's just there and it doesn't seem to be changing.
So who do you think should challenge that? When you say that, the person who hears that? There's two over here.
Should I stand up and hold it? Okay. My name is Janet Seymour. I live here in Helena. And I feel like I'm misbehaving, so let me just tell you this. There's the question or the concern that I have is I'm remembering in the 60s, okay, now everything's great and groovy. We had grassroots stuff happening. It wasn't the same everywhere, but there was this richness that was coming from that. And there was also cross-cultural things that were happening from the ground up. It's an amazing organization that you have that covers any number of things this way. And as Rudy Giuliani would say, up and down. I shouldn't have said that. I guess what I'm, two things. One is that sense of it just literally coming from the ground. And also I was concerned about the I saw a lot of white people there. I didn't see very many people of other colors or cultures. That's all. But I am very interested in working this system in some kind of way that may be more gutsy, I guess.
Great, and that's a very good point in terms of diversity. We've worked very hard at trying to encourage people of color to participate. Our national co-chairs, we have an African-American woman from Ohio, we have a Democrat, and we have a Republican young man from Maine as co-chairs. And generally, the audience is 95% white in terms of people who participate. I will say that in terms of diversity, that some of the more active and understanding people are women as part of the process. And so we're encouraging as many to participate. We particularly want Republican women to participate.
Thank you, Mr. Celeste, for being here, and particularly thank you for your commitment to the Institute and to an important subject in America. I know you travel a lot, and you do workshops and presentations like this. And those of us in Montana understand long distances, so we appreciate what you're doing. I'm wondering about the funding for workshops? How you go about it? Are you is the Institute associated with the National Association of Legislators or any of the groups that occasionally make presentations to members of Congress? And if I might ask, what's the usual cost to either state legislatures or the legislators themselves for a presentation?
Good question. And I meant to ask this before, whether there were any present legislators or who are here. I know there are some past legislators, but I don't think there are any present ones. We've been in contact with a couple. Kelly McCarthy is one that we've talked to because we're interested in coming to Montana if the folks here would like to have us. There is no charge to either the state or to the legislators who participate. And generally it's funded by, we're a 501c3. We have a number of institutional type investors, a couple different funds, the Hewlett Fund, the Democracy Fund. And so that's where much of it comes from. But in order for this to be successful, and we might encourage the Wheeler Center to think about this, we look to local institutions to partner with us so that there'll be some place to sustain the momentum and keep it going, so it's not a one-and-done situation. So that partnership can be as much as we'll share the cost or we'll pay the whole cost, or as little as we have a space that we could provide you, or we're used to doing presentations like this with the legislature, and we'll help you work together. So we do look for local partners in doing that, and certainly would encourage the Wheeler Center to think about it. Other questions? Yes, sir. Here comes the mic. By one of our fellows.
Thank you. I'm Brad Snow with the Wheeler Center. Thank you very much, Ted, for a wonderful talk. I'm wondering, the legislatures are organized on a partisan basis, caucus, Congress is organized that way. So much of political life is organized on a partisan basis. How did you find your efforts to be, you were a Democratic legislator. How did it work for you? You told some great anecdotes about it, but what did you learn from your experience in the Ohio legislature? How did it work for you as you caucused with the Democrats, but you were trying to follow your own path? You weren't an independent. You caucused with the Democrats. Did you feel like there were Republicans in the legislature who were like-minded? How do we get to a place where there's more work like the work you were doing in the Ohio legislature, by practicing politicians?
I think part of it, looking at my own experience, part of it was I had the benefit of coming in the minority, so I watched other people run committees and had to live with however they ran them, not having my amendments heard, not being recognized, those kinds of things, and saying, if I get in that position, what will I do? And I don't think that's the right way to lead. So I did have that opportunity. We did win the majority my second term, and I was chair of two committees, and sat down with each of the Republican members and said, what are your priorities for this committee? What would you like to see done? And to me, I could still get done what I wanted to have done, but that small gesture made a huge difference to those folks who were watching. And when it came back time around again then, so when we're in the minority, a couple of the people who had been in those committees and had recognized that responded in kind to me. They didn't necessarily do it with everybody, but they responded in kind because I'd taken the time to reach out to them, and that made a difference. Also, on a very difficult bill, I introduced the elimination of the death penalty bill in Ohio. And I made a point of going in to see the governor, who was against it at the time, and to tell him I'm this isn't political. I really believe in this, strongly in this, and I know that his faith took him in a different direction than my faith was taking me on that issue. And so I explored that same discussion with all the members of the committee that was here, that were hearing the bill, and took a colleague of mine who was a freshman, and I said, I think you'll want to consider this in the future. She ended up being one of the co-sponsors, and she couldn't understand what we were doing there. And now she's the prime sponsor of the bill, and she's doing the same thing, and has found it's made a big difference, and found actually that there were two people that we'd identified from Republican caucus who were unlikely supporters, but primarily because of the life issue. So they were consistent on the life issue, and they said they would support this as well. Yes.
Well, this is a short question. What are your thoughts on alphabetical seating in legislative bodies?
Oh, I like that one. We've had probably of the 12 states we were in, four or five of them have brought up seating, talking about how, you know, I'm assuming everybody knows ordinarily it's seated with the Republicans on one side and the Democrats on the other, and you never get a chance to really talk to each other. And folks have talked about, I hadn't heard the alphabetical suggestion. I've heard about just mixing it up and so that there's Republicans and Democrats sitting together, but I like the alphabetical seating as long as that works. In some states, when it's 4-5-1, one party or the other, it's not going to make too much of a difference, but I think that's a great idea.
I was curious whether there's ever any, I don't want to say exactly backlash, but if there's like repercussions as people are working together, if Discord had a purpose or was serving some purpose, are there people who are getting less campaign funds or backlash to the process?
Yeah, a little bit. It one example is we have a person in Ohio who's a state senator, and he's in a swing district, and he is a very strong believer in this whole process. He tells a story about going out to have a cup of coffee with a Democrat, and before he'd even got back to the office, his iPhone was buzzing saying, what are you doing having that conversation? And he said, well, he was talking about going into the military, and I'd served in the military, and I was giving him some advice about that. That's what I was doing meeting with him. I mean, it's crazy. But he also realized that because he's in that swing district, that his primary could be his tough race, and by participating with us, he could be criticized as, you know, being the compromiser or what have you, and not being conservative enough. And it didn't matter. He hands down, it was the fact that he really worked hard and he listened to people and he worked with people. That was the difference. So it's not too many cases where that happens, but it's often. If leadership is suspicious of why this is being done and somehow sees it as threatening to their leadership, then there could be repercussions. But lately, it's gone the other direction. I mean, in the example in Idaho was fabulous. I mean, it just it's made a big difference with the leadership involvement. It's their idea; they brought it together. So it's a big change in how it's done.
I'm just wondering if there's more civility in legislatures if a house is evenly divided or pretty closely evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. if they are more civil, since they have to work together to get things accomplished, or if it's more civil, if they have overwhelmingly have control of the House, and say there's 50 Republicans and only 12 Democrats, so they can afford to be more civil because they can just get things through.
That's a good question, and there's no general rule, but and there's going to be another question over here when you're done. What we've found coming from a swing state where our House was going back and forth, so we're pretty evenly divided. There was a lot of incivility, and it was aimed at making the other guys the demons. I mean, they were the bad guys, and so no matter what the issue you were discussing was, it became a partisan issue, even if there was no partisan quality to it. You want to win, at all counts, and that's the difference. And you go to Idaho was 4-1 Republican, and they, that just seemed to be their nature to be civil, although the folks in the Democrats in the minority would say, well, we don't quite get all the things heard we'd like to have heard. And within the caucus, within the Republican caucus, there's more disparity than there is between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Thank you for an excellent lecture. How can you bring this to voters? How can this resonate with voters?
Two ways. One is let me go back to this screen, and the one that I mentioned of going to our website, where we ask people to sign this pledge. And the pledge is really for individuals to commit to the same kinds of things that we're expecting our elected officials to. So there's it's on civic groups to do it among themselves, but we are encouraging, one of the things that's an outgrowth of our effort that up to this point had just been the half-day workshops, the group that got together, this national network, is now taking the lead on introducing this Text Talk Civility Matters to their constituents and trying to get their constituents to participate. We've done like mini town hall type things or mini house parties where folks gather to get them talking about it. And part of it is just to get the discussion going, and this provides a good means to get that discussion going.
Perhaps a silly question, but if you have a civil discussion with someone trying to accomplish something and you're unsuccessful, how would you process that?
So you're unsuccessful in promoting civility, or you're unsuccessful in getting your issue passed? Well, that's a good one, because I've had to deal with that back in my community. Some folks asked me to help. Upper Arlington is a kind of, actually it used to be in my House district, and it's mostly Republican. And they had a bond issue which was passed. And the councilman told the citizens in Upper Arlington, this is what it's going to be spent for. Everybody didn't hear exactly what it was going to be spent for, so that when the council decided that it would be spent on fixing a park a certain way, they all got up in arms and said, you're not listening, and had a meeting and said, you're not letting us talk. The mayor asked me to come talk to all the council and to the people who were leading the opposition to have one of these discussions. So we had a mini workshop, if you will, and I thought it went pretty well. And then 2 weeks later, they filed 3,000 signatures to recall all those councilmen. So hopefully the recall was just held. It failed. Hopefully they're going to get back to the table and have that discussion and really listen this time. I mean, part of it is process. Big part of it is process. How you design it so that people feel they're being heard, that they have a fair place at the table. Often, you know, if counsel's sitting up here and says, well, you only have 2 minutes and you can speak and then that's it. And we, in our workshops, everybody's the same. We're all sitting in a circle. We really have we take the time to make people respect each other's conversation. Generally, you'll get to a conclusion where that's not a problem, but it doesn't always work. Glad to see so many questions. Whatever. I just need a little more water, maybe.
First of all, I want to thank you for this presentation. I'm one of the co-founders of something called One Montana. And and one of our first things that we did was actually partner with the Wheeler Center on a conference on the graying of Montana. And we had to bring definitely different people from different both sides of the aisle, but also from both universities. And our universities here are a little bit like, at times, like the Buckeyes and the Wolverines. Now, you shouldn't do that because I'm a Wolverine.
Yeah, I've heard about
that. But anyhow, is that that we started, it was started by, at the time, the second-ranking Republican in the state. Was the state senator, Senate president, and myself, who's not elected, but known fairly well as a Democrat in the state. And we then went to, we went to the two university presidents and said, you know, it's fine to be enemies in November, but the rest of the year, how can we work together? And, you know, this is a small state. There's only 1 million of us. And so it's easy to sort of begin to work in various different ways. How do we get more connected? We are definitely more connected than we're divided. So let's focus on that, which is what we've been trying to do. And we have not taken so much the legislative approach yet, but worked on what are issues that can bring us together. And so far, so good. But it's something that we in our state here in Montana, we need to learn from what you're doing and from what others are doing in this particular area. But I feel that there's actually some hope in our state that we at times think we're really divided. In many ways, if you use a different language, we're not. We have found that dealing with the issue of climate, where many people in agriculture might say that's a bad issue. But if you use the right language, then they're all for it, and then they start working with climate science as long as climate scientists have the same language. I just came through, because this is a pretty rural state, we just had a meeting this week with landowners and sportsmen who, unfortunately, over the last 50 years, there's been a real lack of trust. And working with them in the kind of environment where we have rules of conduct, we call it a safe space, that what was said by a longtime conservative Republican landowner about the person representing the local wildlife federation after the meeting was, I've never heard that from him before. That's phenomenal. We can now work on this particular issue. So all I'm saying is that what you're doing can work. Yes, it's going to take a lot of hard work. It does take going out of our little silos and go and talking and reaching across the aisle. That's not a bad thing. The word collaboration is often in many circles is a bad term. You never should compromise. How do we get anywhere if we don't start talking across the aisle? or with different points of view like you're suggesting. So I just wanted to say thank you. I'm not trying to promote anything other than we in Montana are really wrestling with this in many different ways. And we've got a lot of work to do, but that doesn't mean we're certainly giving up on this issue. You're only encouraging, so thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that, and thank you for what you're doing. And I might mention I went back to this slide because a lot of the organizations here in particular, I was going to point out to one, I think it's Living Room Conversations. The two people who put that together are unlikely friends, Grover Norquist and Joan Blades. Joan Blades is the creator of MoveOn.org, and they've created this Living Room Conversation. And it's pretty powerful. People are, I mean, they look for opportunities to bring people from really different backgrounds and put them in environments where there's a safe space and you can really do it. Thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks. I was just wondering if the media has a responsibility or a role to play in stability and civility and promoting it. It seems like sometimes the headlines that are used and the questions that are asked in debates are geared up to promote fighting and heat rather than enlightenment. And I was just wondering if they have a role to play in this.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we did that I put that list of events that were done last October in Ohio, we had journalists and civic groups and elected officials get together. And much as you saw with everybody listing on the things on the wall about their beliefs about each other, and the media heard the public basically saying, we don't trust you. You don't tell us the truth. You have ulterior motives. You're only going for the money for the advertisers. There were a whole wide range of things that they'd heard that it was expressed in a different way than they'd heard before, and it made an impact. And particularly going into 2016, they said, okay, what? And that was part of the workshop's purpose, what could we do differently? 20 news organizations in Ohio, as a result of that conversation, got together and said, in 2016, we're going to do it differently. Together, we will promote to the candidates coming into Ohio that they talk about what people in Ohio want to hear about. And they started that process by doing a huge sample throughout the state, asking a question of what are the most important issues to you, open-ended. No, you know, no bias in it. It was just open-ended. And they got this whole range of issues that the people responded. They sent that to the candidates and said, if you want our coverage, this is what you're going to talk about. They also did a whole series, and they're still doing it, on the impact of negative advertising, which I think is phenomenal. They said, here's what to watch out for. Here's what to look for. You're going to see, and in our state, I mean, it's incredible. Our state Senate race, there's been more millions of dollars spent in that one Senate race than all of the others combined in the country. All negative. All name-calling, all awful. You just, you know, you don't want to watch TV. They did a really nice description for people in the paper about what to look for, what are the impacts, what does it mean to you, and it's a much different dialogue between the media and the people. I think they realize they have a role in this. And, you know, there's a big debate going on now about is the media fair to Hillary or is the media fair to Trump or are they, you know, in someone's pocket? And the reality is it's still a business. The president of CBS said, well, it may not be good for the country, but great for Trump. You know, I mean, it's what's happening. Hopefully, we by our little small changes here as we go along, we're going to make a difference. And I think that some of them recognize it. Did I see you, Winch? Are you in the press? No, you're part of there.
Yes, a couple of weeks ago, I think it was in the Atlantic, there was a very thought-provoking article about how many of the things that we've done to clean up our democracy and our politics in the past several decades seem to have made it grind to a screeching halt. A lot of the grease that used to make democracy work isn't there any longer. And one of those things is term limits. And I'm wondering how term limits work into the kind of project that you have here, where people are not turning over and over, but they're not staying for a whole career, maybe, in politics, because some states will have term limits. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, and I think that's something that comes up when we talk about this within our workshops. The legislators will raise it. Term limits are viewed as something whose purpose didn't get served, that there's another way that you can get people out of office. It's, you know, vote them out. And that it just, in Ohio, for instance, you can move from the House to the Senate and back from the Senate to the House, and so you can go 8 years, 8 years, 8 years. And so people start thinking about that before their first time is done, and you're planning on it, how am I going to get over there, and that, so there's a lot of that. And what happens is the powerful impact it has for the lobbyists, because they become the institutional memory, and they're the ones. Now, that's not all bad. They're good lobbyists. They're folks who, you know, thankfully are work hard at their and represent folks that in a good way. But they're not the ones who were elected to be doing that. And so, you know, it really requires some institutional memory. The other thing, and probably more negative impact, is the redistricting. It's been huge. And what it's done is changed the nature of the elections from, you no longer have general elections, it's all in the primaries. It's all who can move to which direction, the, you know, further left or further right, the quickest.
Thank you very much for coming today, Mr. Celeste. I'm Robin Askate. I'm also a board member on the Wheeler Center and a political science major a long time ago. But you hear that, you know, democracy is a messy business, and there's been rancor and divisiveness may be just a part of democracy. And even from the founding of our country 240 years ago, it was a messy business. And you're looking at the big picture of our nation's history. Do you see that incivility has been on a gradual decline, a downward slope, say, from, you know, our Continental Congress 240 years ago when we broke with Britain? Or do you see a cycle where we'll trend downward, then there'll be a correction, we'll clean up our act a little bit? How do you see the big picture?
Well, I think, you know, long ago, dueling was one way to take care of business, and some of the shouting matches that went on in Congress were much worse than what you saw. So, I think, if anything, it kind of peaked and had a period where folks tried to work together. Part of it in D.C., I think, and I'd appreciate the congressman's view, is that I think what happened is people no longer had time to get to know each other. You just really were, you know, back and forth, and you didn't have time to be friends and get to know each other, even if it's across the aisle. And once that happened, then it started to go back down. So there was a period where people stayed there, they got together, they knew each other, they were acquainted, they knew their families, and now it's gone in the other direction.
I would respond to that, but in a larger sense, the difficulty of the task. This is an enormous task. And we're talking about maybe less than half of the solution, which is members of state legislatures and Congress. My belief is one of the reasons the act, without a lot of civility, is because they want to get reelected, and the constituents, particularly that slim margin that they need from the independents or the base of the Democrats or Republicans, that slim margin are among the most partisan, angry, conspiratorial people in this country, far more partisan than elected officials. It was about a year ago that a former congressman, a friend of mine, Republican, who followed me one member later into the Congress, Dennis Rehberg from Billings, who some of you know and many of you know of, was giving a speech in Missoula. And when he was introduced, I had a seat in the front row. I got there early, wanted to hear Dennis. I got up and joined him at the podium just to shake his hand and let people know that a relatively liberal Democrat could be friends with a relatively conservative Republican. And afterwards, for a month, I caught absolute hell. Absolute hell. From other politicians? No, from the constituents. What in the hell are you doing, Williams? Why would you be seen shaking hands with, right? You know who's to blame? Alexander Hamilton had it right. He said, here, sir, speaking to the House, here, sir, the people govern. People are in large part responsible for the divisions in this country. Why? Because when we go fishing for votes, we, those of us who've won a few times, know where the fishing holes are. And they are with those people who insist on electing the most conservative or the most liberal and the most partisan. Check it out. Check it out. Did I love my constituents? You bet. Were they more partisan than I was? Absolutely.
Well put. One more question. Anybody else have a question? Here we go.
It's difficult to follow the congressman. Being a former senior bureaucrat, both for state and federal, and elected official, your presentation, and I've heard similar over the years, is really frightening. And I'll tell you why. I would have to take responsibility of being elected official in what I say. The present one works well because I can find the scapegoat. And I take it offense of being there and being criticized in the press. But I tell you, the press is the greatest institution we have going. And I get a little irritated about that. And I've been quoted in the national newspapers and the Hungry Horse News and all of that. But I want to tell you, they're holding us together. You may think that. And it's hard for politicians because they catch me lying. So I take a little offense and I defend the press. The press is what's kept us going. And the other thing is simply the problem is not in Washington, D.C. The problem is not in Washington, D.C. You sent those people there. So stop blaming us in Washington, D.C. Think about when you go out your front door. In my opinion, just like the congressman says, if you're going to be the rebel rouser and get the vote for us, we're going to represent you well. But I can tell you, and I've entertained most of your presidents and a lot of your senators and this kind of stuff, And yes, we have lost something. I can remember them flying to the Virgin Islands or Camp David or to Grand Teton, and you have Republicans and Democrats. Now, they may, on this floor, call them each other's SOB, but at that time it was mostly males, but their spouses were out playing bridge. They're getting on a plane, flying down for the weekend. And when I think that is the biggest problem in the House, you never get to learn. And in my opinion, if you haven't been in the House 3 terms, they don't know your name. They may let you have a bathroom. And so I think we always are saying, well, Ohio must be the problem. It couldn't be Montana. But you elected us, and how you elected us, we're going to represent you in that manner. So the problem is not Washington, D.C. The problem is Helena. I'll leave it there and let you think about it. And I'd just like you to comment that I think we forget the simplicity we're talking about here, and we want to make it complex. And I come out of the Wyoming legislature. Do we still even know the word Democrat? I'll move on then. But I want to tell you, I think we want to find a scapegoat. We want to find a scapegoat instead of listening to how to get along. And it's right here in Helen. It's in these chairs here. It isn't next door. It isn't back over to my meeting on livestock in Lewistown today. It's here. So don't try to keep finding somebody else. And this gentleman brings us a great opportunity. But I'm going to vote for those, that narrow band, as the congressman says. Thank you, and I'm sorry it took so much time.
I just have a quick question. What's the circulation of the hungry horse?
Where's some of my flathead friends? I would say, yes. Yeah, probably that. Well, Mel Ruder, if you operated a national park at that time, in Glacier National Park, you read the newspaper to find out how you should operate the park.
Does that do it for you? How are we done? I really appreciate everyone's patience and willingness to stay here through the presentation and the questions, and I appreciate your interest and concern about this issue. And please know that we're happy to come back to work with the legislature, to work with you in any way. As you can tell, this is something that's near and dear to me, and I believe in it very much. Thank you again so much.